So our friend Carrie Grass has a new book coming out, and she's going to tell us all about it. And she had a piece that, out at the Theology of Home website that we talked about the other day. She's on the Dude Maker Hotline here with us. Carrie, good morning to you. Happy Feast of Our Lady of Guadalupe to you.
Good morning. Thanks so much. And to you, too.
So, tell me about this new book that you have coming out. And by the way, congratulations on the upgrade. This book is published by Regnery Press. Pretty soon you won't be returning my calls.
Oh, goodness, stop. Never. this is a secular book. So that was one of the reasons why it just seemed like it had to be a secular publisher. And gratefully, Regnery picked it up. But yeah, it's called The End of Woman, How Smashing the Patriarchy Has Destroyed Us. So not provocative at all in terms of the title.
No, not provocative at all.
Yeah. In any event, this kind of is a prequel to The Anti-Mary because it goes back all the way to the early feminists. And you know, when I wrote The Anti-Mary, I only really focused on the 1960s and beyond. And, you know, I had people asking me and you know, my own thoughts. I always wondered what was before all of this and what do I dig into and, you know, what would I find? And, oh my goodness, did I find things I never believed I would find. So this book starts with Mary Wollstonecraft and just shows that step by step how all of these things happened that led us to this point where we can't define what a woman is. And, you know, we're telling our daughters they can have chest surgeries and become boys. You know, all of it really just is, you know, built upon each other. And I was also amazed by how much, you know, communism really entered into the whole picture in ways I never dreamed. You know, Betty Friedan had deep roots as a communist that never came to light. She did a great job of trying to hide them. And it was a really fascinating book to research, and it will be out next year, but I've been dropping a few articles with some of the content in it. And the one you referenced from last week was in the Epoch Times, and then we were able to repost it at my site. And, you know, there'll be things coming up as in the build up to the book coming out next summer.
I never heard of Mary Wollstonecraft. I never heard that name. Yeah. I never heard of Elizabeth Cady Stanton. Now, of course, everyone's heard of Susan B. Anthony. Who was Mary Wollstonecraft, and why do we care?
Okay, so Mary Wollstonecraft is considered basically the first feminist, and she lived during the time of the French Revolution. She was actually a big supporter of the French Revolution until she went there and, you know, all of her friends were killed by Robespierre and others. But she was saved because her American lover had registered her as his wife, and so that she was protected as an American, even though they weren't legally married. So she ended up writing a book called The Vindication of the Rights of Women that was really foundational in terms of the feminist movement. And so I go back and chronicle that, but there's a lot of socialist elements there. You know, socialism wasn't organized yet, but there were the roots of that. But one of the things that she did was talk about women as human beings, which I think she did it innocently enough, but it was picked up later on by the likes of someone like Simone de Beauvoir. You know, she's making a distinction that we're not chattel, we're not animals and whatnot. But what that ends up happening over the generations is this idea that a woman is a person or a human being. And, you know, I'm sure people have heard that was one of the slogans of the feminist movement was, you know, feminism is the radical idea that a woman is a human being. So it was used, this concept was used over and over again among others. But anyway, so what it did in our minds was sort of create this primary category of humanity that no longer did you have to be male or female. You could certainly be this like carte blanche human that didn't have a sex. And so you build up to someone like Simone de Beauvoir, who's all about reinventing yourself, you know, using the ideas of Nietzsche. And that's what we're left with, is that a woman can be a human being, but she doesn't have any connection with her body, with maternity, with, you know, none of the things about her body inform what she is. And this is why we really have gone to the point where we can't define woman, because we've tried to extract all those pieces that are connected with motherhood out of what it means to be a woman. And then, of course, you see the trans people moving into all of that. So anyway, that got kicked off with Wollstonecraft, but she also made no bones about talking about how much she just regarded and thought any kind of hierarchy was bad, whether it was military or the church or government. So she seeded all, these planted the seeds for all this, and then it just explodes. And some of it even happens with her own immediate family. She died in childbirth, but her daughter, Mary Shelley, wrote Frankenstein. Her son-in-law was Percy B. Shelley, who's the poet, who actually I was shocked to find how much of an influence he had on the early suffragettes. So anyway, it was just one of these things where, one piece led to another and another and another, and it just all came, it was like all woven together. So it's a fascinating book. I mean, it was really amazing to research it and tug on some of these strings and, find things that I never thought. Because I think we think of the 1800s as sort of this Victorian era.
Right.
And yet that nothing could be further from the truth in terms of what was happening at these different layers of culture. There's another woman that almost nobody's heard of called Victoria Woodhull, who was called by the press Mrs. Satan. And she was a major influence upon Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton. So anyway, just these amazing characters and could really see the movement formed early. Because I was sort of always under the impression that there was this left-hand turn that was taken by feminism in the 60s. And I think that's what most of us think. But really, all of these elements of trying to take motherhood away from women. And, and much of it was genuine effort to try to help women. They saw the suffering, and it was awful, terrible suffering that women went through. But the question they were asking was, how do we make women more like men, instead of how do we alleviate women's suffering as women? And I think that's the fundamental problem.
Yeah, your friend and mine, Paul Kingor, when he wrote The Devil and Karl Marx, I mean, people think that Marx began with whatever statement in the 1870s or what have you, and that's just not true. There was a history that led up to Marx that made Marx possible.
Mm-hmm.
So,
that's exactly right.
I mean, but I'm just listening to this history that you're laying out here, and this is fascinating stuff. And I'm also reminded that, the charms of a woman, if you will, we're responsible for one of the great, since we're in the month of December and it's coming up here, for one of the great shocking military victories in all of the world, in world history up to that time. And that, I don't know if you know this, but there was a woman that was responsible for Washington's crossing of the Delaware River on Christmas night, 1776. She would come down to us known as the Widow of Mount Holly. And no one knows who there are two pair of researchers that did actually research this and found out. So do you know what the Widow of the Widow of Mount Holly's signal accomplishment was?
No.
She kept Baron de Rochambeau. She kept him at her home with his lieutenants.
Oh, wow.
Cooking and cleaning and flashing her cleavage at him while Washington was sailing up the Delaware River. and when he found out he'd been had, of course, he...
Wow.
Yeah, it's a true story. It's in my movie, The Times That Try Man's Souls. So some people thought it was Betsy Ross, but it wasn't Betsy Ross, but it was. Mm-hmm. But so in the 1770s, there still were women that were willing to act like women and get things done.
Now, that's remarkable. I had never heard that story before. So, well, speaking of Paul Kingor, actually, I used his new book. He's got the new book, The Devil and Bella Dodd.
And Bella Dodd, right.
Came out. Yeah, and I was fascinated by Bella Dodd because, of course, she was a communist and deeply embedded in the party. She was very influential in teachers' unions, unionizing teachers and education. But she also set up this group, the legal side of it, called Congress for American Women, that was definitely on the radar of the congressional group setting on American activities long before McCarthy. And anyway, this group was just completely bankrolled by the Communist Party, the International Communist Party. But they did all kinds of events and were just this group of women. And, who was among them but Betty Friedan? So anyway, it was really interesting to then read The Feminine Mystique, because at one point in one of her chapters, she has chapter 9, she has sort of this offhanded remark. And, Feminine Mystique sold like 22 million copies and was hugely influential in terms of getting women to leave the home. But in it, she makes it clear, you know, she uses almost a direct quote from the founding of this Congress for American Women. One of the ideas, and Bella Dodd lays this out, is they wanted to get American women to stop buying so much because they wanted to cripple capitalism. So she has this remark in her in Chapter 9 saying almost verbatim the exact same thing, but she makes it sound like it was something that just came to her in the grocery aisle, you know, that it wasn't something she'd been stewing on for 30 years. So there's that element, and then, of course, she also had among her journals one Marxist quote written by Marx that said something to the effect of, you know, women will never be free until they are out of the home. So she used all, you know, that was what was really the engine behind what she was doing. But she used psychology. She used a very kind of popular style of writing to appeal to women and to really sort of push on that part of a woman's heart that's, you know, tender, that can feel victimized very, very easily. And so she just, like, lunged into that, and I think she was incredibly successful. And this is why we see, you know, certainly the 80s, where you've got the whole influence of the padded shoulders and briefcases and, you know, women wearing suits and all of that kind of thing. So anyway, it's just fascinating to see all of these just concentric circles of influence and the way that they played out in pop culture.
And most people today, we hear like Betty Friedan. Who's Betty Friedan? Well, first of all, dude, you don't want to know. Don't look a picture of her because you'll give up your breakfast. This is not a very. She was just a detestable woman. And she wasn't the only one. You know, I'm old enough to remember when you were probably still in high school. Eleanor Smeal and Patricia Ireland and Schroeder.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, Molly Yard and all the angry, ugly women that sometimes I long for them because maybe they would stand up to those that want to kick girls out of girls' sports and go like, you can't do that. Mm-hmm. Only girls can play girls' sports.
Yeah. No, it's true. There's a lot of that. No, and there's so many of them. I mean, that was the remarkable thing, too, was just figuring out, you know, which ones were influenced by the Frankfurt School and Marcuse and, you know, all of these different interjections of ideologies into American family life. And, that, you know, fundamentally, that was really the effort, was how do we destroy the family? And how do we make women not women? So, really ugly.
Well, I think one of the I've talked to three people in the last 6 months that I've had interviews with, and all three have said something similar when I ask them a question about, well, in your vote, was there a divided vote in your household? And all three guys came back and said, well, I don't know because I didn't ask. But what we really should be doing is not just repealing the 19th Amendment, is what we should be doing is we should be going back to or going to a system where there is one vote per one household and be very, very emphatic on the household nature of it. You know, because to kick the woman out of the home was to make a woman more, as you point out, just read the piece of Theology of Home. To make a woman more like a man. I don't want my wife to be like a guy. Mm-hmm. I want her to be like a woman. But when you think about it, though, okay, your book perfectly explains Brittany Griner. This is how we get a Brittany Griner. Now, there's always been tomboys.
Yeah.
Don't misunderstand.
Right.
Brittany Griner is not a tomboy. She is an angry, I will never be a mother or I will never be a real woman. She is an angry, I am 6 foot tall, 6 foot six lesbian, hear me roar because I'm 6 foot six. You know, the Russians are actually just, I watch shows on RT TV and watch the translations. They're just, they're mocking us and they're mocking her for this reason.
Yeah. No, and it's tragic, too. I mean, she's obviously sensationalized and a celebrity and clearly politically protected in ways that the rest of us wouldn't be. But the real tragedy is what's happening to the young girls. These are, you know, the young girls that are, Abigail Schreier's book points out. And a lot of us know these young women. I mean, this is the tragedy. This is a one-off. These are little girls all around the country that they don't really want to be boys. They just know they don't want to be girls. As Schreier makes plain, you know, they are uncomfortable in these sort of new bodies. They're also a little bit awkward. And so this gives them instant popularity and affirmation, you know, from the president down. You know, of course they're going to be excited about it when they finally have a crowd cheering them on that they didn't have, you know, when they were just awkward girls. And we all go through those phases at different times in our lives. So that I think that's the thing that's the most tragic element of it, because they're being sterilized. They're having things done to their bodies that cannot be undone. And, you know, how many of us did things that when we were in high school that we absolutely regret? But thanks be to God, they weren't irreparable. And that's the real tragedy here, is that they are making decisions that can absolutely not be, you know, let's any kind of easy.
Carrie Gress is the author. She's on our Jewmaker Hotline. A new book coming out is called The End of Woman, How Smashing the Patriarchy Has Destroyed Us. You quote Abigail Schreier in here and the piece at The Theology of Home. You know, Abigail Schreier has done a lot of great work in trying to dissuade young girls to not mutilate themselves and trying to show them, look, this is what's going to happen to you. And this is not a maybe. This is probably what's going to happen to you. Mm-hmm. But then everything that Abigail Schreier does gets undone by a creep like Biden, who invites this thing. What is that creature's name? Mulvaney. Invites Dylan Mulvaney to the White House. And then Dylan Mulvaney, who's a man, pretending to be a woman, goes on to mock all women and say that, well, I'm a woman because I like to shop. These are stereotypes. Does that mean I don't like to shop?
All of them.
Oh, they're all stereotypes, but they're stupid stereotypes.
Right, or the hypersexualization, that's the other aspect of the drag queen and whatnot. So, yeah, they're absolutely a mockery and a characterization, or almost a cartoonization of a character. That's the word I'm looking for, of what they think women are, and they feel like they fit into that, and the culture affirms them. So, yeah, that's the problem, is this whole... and if you don't affirm them, then they're a victim, which gives them even greater status. And it's just incredibly tragic what we've done, doing to these people.
I think in your previous work, so this is a good pivot for you, because you've already set the ground for the Marian option and then the anti-Mary. Mm-hmm. Today being the Feast of Our Lady of Guadalupe. You know, I'm rereading and re-getting acquainted with the story, because there's so much to it that a lot of people, myself, I didn't know. Like, for example, I think I might have heard, but I completely forgot, that in 1921, in November of 1921, someone planted a bomb in the Basilica of Our Lady of Guadalupe. It was hidden inside a flower pot that they put at the base of the tilma, and it detonated. And it blew every piece of stained glass out of the basilica. It bent the crucifix like a bent fork. The tilma was completely undamaged, and the altar boys and the priests that were up there near the altar that were completely unharmed. No one was burned. It was just another miracle attributed to Our Lady of Guadalupe. But what people have to understand about Our Lady of Guadalupe, and what the Aztecs, Americans today don't get it, but apparently the Aztecs did, is the Aztecs saw this black stash across her belly and went, she's with child. That's a good thing. Her hands being folded in, there's another part of the image that says that not only is she with child, but she is with a royal child. So Our Lady of Guadalupe came not as a woman trying to be a man. She came as 100% woman. I love what she told St. Juan Diego on the second apparition. You go in my name and make known my wish in its entirety, that he has to start the erection of a temple which I ask of him. And again, tell him that I, in person, the ever-Virgin Holy Mary, Mother of God, sent you. So she does all things. When people say, you Catholics and your worship of Mary... Mary doesn't worship Mary. Mary says, I do all things because I am the mother of God.
That was the other thing that the Aztecs picked up, because of the way her head is bowed slightly, was they knew she wasn't a goddess. That was one of the other pieces about it. So it was very clear to them that this wasn't a goddess to be worshipped, but the real God was the child with which she was pregnant. There's a flower, I think, also in her dress that is a symbol of divinity. That was another clue for them. So all of that stuff is just absolutely fascinating. But you're right. Yeah, we obviously don't worship her, and even the Aztecs.
The Aztecs didn't either.
Iconography.
But the Aztecs, Father Wolf tells the story in his sermon that he gave yesterday, that when the Aztecs would hear the black robes were coming, they would run out with their little carvings of Our Lady of Guadalupe and fall at their knees and beg them, please baptize me. I want to be under her.
Beautiful. Yeah. No, it's beautiful. Yeah. So anyway, I think, you know, we've got to work it out for us because
we
it's
do.
Just a message that women that haven't heard. And I think there's a lot of compassion that we have to have for women because, you know, the one thing that just kept blowing me away was like, why haven't we heard this? Why am I the first person to write this book? You know, why have we let these 200 years just languish and not paid attention to them, what they've been telling us and saying to us and indoctrinating us with, especially in terms of the media, you know, all these different ways that they have allowed or that they have really given us this message, you know, force-fed us this message. And, you know, we haven't really provided a way for women to think of themselves otherwise. And, you know, that's the beauty of the church and our devotion to Our Lady is that that's what is offered. And I know I never would have found it. You know, I was right along with all these other women in the culture. And I know it was because of my devotion to Our Lady that my eyes started being opened little by little and slowly. And, you know, I think all of us are still recovering from this. This is something that, you know, it takes a very, very long time to sort of get it out of your system and be aware of it. But that's what, you know, she's here to help us with as a mother, to help us understand what it really does mean to be a woman and to find happiness in that. I mean, that's the thing that just astounds me is there's so much data that shows how unhappy women are, and they just keep pushing it. They just keep pushing it and keep pushing it. And they know it. They know that there's the happiness metrics are not showing happier women. But it doesn't really matter. That's not really what they're after, the flourishing of women. They're really after power and control.
Yeah, and I also think it's very encouraging that you're publishing this book through Regnery because there are a lot of people that wouldn't have read it otherwise if you published it at Tan or in Ignatius.
Yep.
But now someone that would read Abigail Schreier is going to read Cary Grant, and then maybe they'll go like, what else has she written? Hey, let me go and search.
Yeah.
So I think that's a win-win if you ask me.
Yeah, no, I'm really excited about it. And, you know, I think my background lends a lot to it as well. I think there were some reservations that I might not be able to write a secular book. And I was like, look, I grew up in Oregon, went to the University of Oregon. I took anthropology classes. You know, I dealt with this stuff as a young woman and I didn't have tools. I was just incredibly frustrated because I didn't know how to deal with it on a personal level. You know Oregon and the culture there. You know, so many of these things were happening much sooner than they were happening, you know, in the culture more broadly, just because there's a large lesbian population out there. So anyway, it's just been an amazing gift to finally be able to pinpoint, like, this is why the ideology that's driving your behavior, and this is why you're unhappy, and you will never be happy, you know, I mean, just, it's tragic in so many respects. But it's just also great to know that there's a way to really see where the errors are and, you know, hopefully to try and help people figure it out on their, you know, through this book and to get back to that place where, you know, we don't have to somehow ignore our bodies. And that's really what they want us to do. You know, they've actually pivoted beautifully in terms of, you know, they've really made taboo this idea of essentialism, where you can see that your body informs you about your soul and who you are as a person.
Right.
They've just snipped those two apart, and that's one of those their most powerful tools. But if we can start putting these pieces back for people in a way that makes sense and are, you know, almost self-evident once you think about it a little bit more than what they've allowed us to think about it, then you're really making progress.
So the book comes out in January. So we'll look forward to
it. It's not out till August 15th. Actually, another great feast.
Oh wait, I'm looking at it now. August 15th. I can't wait that long.
Yeah. I know. I feel that way too. So anyway, no, it's not coming out till then. We're still in the back and forth of the editing, and we're going to go to print hopefully in the spring. So, yeah.
Okay. So
we're going as fast as we can, though.
You could write two more between now and then.
I probably will. You know that. You know me. I'm tired of books. I say this every time. My kids just tease me like, "Let me say you're done," and then here comes another one. So anyway, we'll see.
Well, my friend Fiorello Nash says she's tired of books too, but then she goes like, "Oh, I have to write another one. I'm going to." I'm just going to do one more, but that's it.
Yeah, I can appreciate that.
Well, we hope you keep writing, or at least keep writing at Theology of Home and at The Epic Times. She is Carrie Gress. You can find her at carriegress.com. You can also find Theology of the Home in our Founders Trading Post store. We have some copies left over from May that are signed by Carrie. What are we up to? Theology of Home, Volume 3 now, right?
Yeah. And these can make great, great, great Christmas gifts. They're beautiful. You can give them to people that may be a little bit lukewarm. They just suck people in, because we use that model that the left used to destroy us, which is, you know, they assert their ideas in something beautiful. So we thought, why don't we make something beautiful with our ideas? And so they're not heavy-handed. They're just something that I think people really delight in. So, pick those up as Christmas gifts.
Advent Christmas is a great time to do all of that. You have the opportunity right now. And Christmas doesn't end until my birthday on Candlemas. So why are you leaving your Christmas decorations up? Because it doesn't end until February. That's the other thing. All right. Well, I will let you get back to your busy mothering and candle making and bookmaking and whatever else it is that you're doing these days. She's Carrie Gress. Find her at carriegress.com. Of course, all of her books, or most of them, you can find at shop.mikechurch.com, including Theology of Home, which is in the ladies' gift pack this year, as it is every year. Carrie, as always, well, I'll congratulate you in August 2023, but preemptive congratulations on the book, and I'm sure that we will talk soon.
Thank you.
And God bless you. And
Preemptively, thank you. So I appreciate it.
Okay. God bless you and your wonderful family and your husband. Tell him I said hi, and we'll talk soon.
He'll send it right back. Thanks so much, Mike.
All right, you're welcome. God bless.